Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Elizabeth Edwards died yesterday at her home in North Carolina after a six-year struggle with breast cancer. She was surrounded by her three surviving children, siblings, friends, and, friends say, her estranged husband, John Edwards. Elizabeth Edwards was an inspiration to millions for her amazing grace under a rain of blows in life. But millions have also wrestled with their own version of her trial by cancer, in themselves, in their families. This hour, On Point, the inspiration of Elizabeth Edwards and the imprint of cancer on so many millions of lives. You can join the conversation. Did she inspire you to keep going, to live? Have you had to find resilience in the face of cancer? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've spoken with Elizabeth Edwards. Many people have over the years. Here she is talking with NPR in 2009, last year, about her book, Resilience, in which she discussed the death of her eldest child, her husband's affair, and her battle since 2004 with breast cancer.
Resilience is accepting your new reality, even if it's less good than the one you had before. You can fight it. You can do nothing but scream about what you've lost, or you can accept that and try to put together something that's good.
Elizabeth Edwards, last year, talking about resilience, yesterday, she died at 61 at her home in North Carolina. Joining us now from Washington is Eleanor Clift, contributing editor to Newsweek and author of 2 Weeks of Life, a memoir of love, death, and politics, a deeply moving book that spoke to us of her own husband's death of kidney cancer in 2005. Eleanor, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for being
here.
Glad
to be with you, Tom.
And from New York, we're joined by Siddhartha Mukherjee, oncologist, cancer researcher, assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University, staff cancer physician at Columbia University Medical Center. His celebrated new book is The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer. Sid, Dr. Mukherjee, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Eleanor, you followed this arc. So many people have in this country over the years of a loved one dying from cancer. You know that scene from your most intimate family situation with your husband. Can you begin to picture this family, this home, this woman surrounded by these children and this estranged husband, John Edwards?
Well, Elizabeth Edwards knew this day was coming, and she prepared for it by living to the very fullest. I remember in early 2007 when the cancer returned, and her husband was embarking on his presidential campaign, mm-hmm. and a lot of people thought that he shouldn't run because of what she was facing. And she insisted that he run, and she threw herself into that campaign. I've written as though her life depended on it, mm-hmm. and maybe it did, but it was her lifeline. And so she lived very fully, and then she also was very clear-eyed about how her diagnosis of cancer would end. And so she was a champion and an advocate for hospice, mm-hmm. and she, in the end, did receive hospice care, though not for very long.
No, we just learned early this week that she was out of the hospital, headed home. It seemed it might be, you know, weeks, months, I don't know, but it was a day and a half.
Yeah, and so I only hope that given all the difficulties she had with her husband, that they found some solace in these, you know, last weeks, months as her cancer worsened, and that they were able to go back and look at some of the old wounds and some of the new wounds and do some healing. I think that's the point of hospice, and I think Elizabeth Edwards knew that. And her words from her book about, you know, accepting the new reality and making something good out of it is how she lived, and it's why she is so inspirational to so many of us.
The marriage had a painful end, but their love was a long one before that end. Siddhartha Mukherjee, Dr. Mukherjee, when you look at Elizabeth Edwards' case, when you looked at cancer across centuries, across millennia, think of her psychological profile in the face of this, what was ultimately, in her case, a death sentence. Is this you know, one in a million? How many people have the inner strength, the resilience, to use her word, to respond to cancer as Elizabeth Edwards did?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the striking things about Elizabeth Edwards right through this period of time was her remarkable grace. Her public persona, in fact, grew to encompass and to embrace so many different things, not just a mother, but also the supporter of her husband, an important political figure in her own right, and of course, soon becoming a beacon for women with breast cancer. And so I think that although she is atypical, and there's something special about Elizabeth Edwards, I think it is absolutely true that her story of resilience is in fact a common story. It is a story that I treat men and women with leukemia, but it's a common story across cancer. This kind of enormous inner strength that only arises or comes to its fruition when you're faced with this diagnosis.
And in a way, it leaves people with little choice but to be resilient. You often cannot see it. You know, it's inside. You're just living and hoping and praying. I mean, there's not much choice, I suppose, Sid.
Well, also, I mean, I think everyone's resilience is different. Some people are resilient by, you know, coming out and making a public issue. Other people's resilience might be more internal, might be more internalized. And they're just like there is no archetypal cancer. There is no archetypal cancer patient. There is a diversity, and why should we expect otherwise? Every personality intersects with illness in a different way, and breast cancer, as I point out in my book, has been particularly charged as a disease in the last century.
Eleanor, we're going to open the phone lines to lots of people today who have no doubt experienced this in their own lives and their own families. I mean, what about your experience with your husband Tom, and his psychological response to cancer? Because that is obviously an enormous part of what people are, the challenge people are confronted with.
Right. You know, Tom was somebody who had trouble handling a sinus infection. And so when he got this diagnosis, he, just as was said, I mean, he really rose to the occasion. And he was very clear-eyed also about what he faced, and yet he was determined to live as fully as he could in the time that he had left. And he became an inspiration in his own way. He was a columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and he wrote a series of very well-received columns in which he assured everybody that he was still flossing, and he was still running, and he expected to be around as long as he could. And he went on a kidney cancer listserv, and where people share their experiences, and he was able to help others. He was not a believer. He said rather proudly that he was an atheist, and that did not facing you know, death that was going to come sooner than he had hoped, did not change his mind about that. I think it only, you know, reinforced his determination to get as much as he could out of the time that he had left.
And what about the two of you, Eleanor? Unlike Elizabeth Edwards and John Edwards, I mean, you were very much together. But how did you deal as a couple, as lovers? In the biggest sense, with the uncertainty, the threat of this that hung over you once it was known.
Well, I remember being a little nervous that he might say, oh, let's just travel the world for 180 days or do something like that. Yeah. And I didn't really want to be taken out of my own comfort zone, my reality, my work. And what I discovered is that that's what Tom wanted. He wanted to live as normally as he could for as long as he could. He continued to write his column. He may have played a little more golf than he did before. And I remember the day he marked sort of the decline that would lead to going into hospice was the day that he had to walk off the golf course instead of being able to finish the round. That to him was a very significant turning point. And so, you know, he taught me a lot about how to deal with a new reality. And sometimes when you watch somebody going through cancer treatments, you think, you know, this is subhuman. How can people do this? And it's amazing what people can adjust to and the fortitude people can find within themselves. And I wonder if we're going to look at some point in the future, we're going to look back at some of these, you know, chemotherapy mm-hmm. and these drug regimens as really horrendous. I really do hope that science can find a better way to attack this disease.
Maybe one day to see them as primitive or brutal, we can hope. Here's Elizabeth Edwards talking just in June of this year with CNN's Larry King about her battle with cancer.
Do the doctors tell you why you're still here?
No, and they don't tell me when they expect me to go. Now, what I understand is it's not going to be. So if I'm feeling good, that's a good sign. Because I'm not. You don't, like, all of a sudden fall off a cliff. It will be. It's a slow decline as the disease progresses.
Pain?
Probably. But, you know, I try really not to focus on what the end is going to look like. The more time I spend doing that, you know, the less time I'm enjoying the days I have now.
Elizabeth Edwards, just last summer. Siddhartha Mukherjee, how much time do you imagine, how much notice do you imagine she had? I mean, clearly early this week they knew something deep was going on, but how clear would it be? Days, weeks in advance?
I think she probably knew weeks, maybe I would say on the order of, you know, 1 to 2 weeks of the decline. You know, she had a very deep instinct for her own body, it seemed, and I think she probably knew about a week before.
A week before, and she gathered her family. She sent a Facebook message out to the many who had taken inspiration from her for many years. There's some of that and a link at our website. Last words to the American public from Elizabeth Edwards. We've got much more to look at here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the life and fight and now death of Elizabeth Edwards with Eleanor Clift of Newsweek and Siddhartha Mukherjee, author of the new book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. She was so very open about the issues in her life, married for so long to a politician, she had little choice. I talked with her in November of 2006 here at On Point about the memoir she had just come out with. And I asked her if someone in such public life, such political life, could still be a genuine person.
I think it's actually the easiest way to be. If you don't feel like you have to, if there's not some pretense, it's actually easier to go out every day. You're not thinking, all right, now I'm putting on my political face. The other thing is, it's actually a more rewarding experience. I mean, you know, these people that I came in contact with, that I hugged or spoke to or spoke in their living rooms, those people are still part of my life.
Those people are still part of my life, she said in 2006, and Elizabeth Edwards still part of many people's lives today. Let's go to our listeners, Attleboro, Massachusetts. Michael, thanks for calling. Michael, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I was really calling to talk about the other cancer in her life, and that was the infidelity piece and the adultery. It's something that affected me in my own life, and, you know, it was always inspirational to look up to her because she had so much more to deal with. And was able to do it with dignity and grace and hold her head up high.
Quite apart from cancer, a sort of model for you in a way, or an inspiration in dealing with that kind of betrayal in life.
Very much so, because, you know, it's a very difficult thing to endure when you're faced with that, and to deal with it while dealing with physical cancer as well. I just can't even imagine. So as bad as it ever got, you can always look to that.
Yeah, Michael, I appreciate your call. Sid Mukherjee, we've got a question from a listener on Facebook who wants to know how John Edwards' philandering, they write here, might have affected her health. You know, they're asking, say, please talk about the mind-body relationship and if there's some teachable moment in that regard here. I mean, she was clearly up against that. On the other hand, she clearly battled succumbing to depression over that. But what about the stress of that kind of real-life betrayal, at the same time her body was in some ways letting her down, big ways?
Well, you know, people often ask is, you know, can stress cause cancer? Can it exacerbate cancer? And I think the data are very, very minimal on that front. But stress certainly has an important role in coping with cancer in the mental sense and our ability to endure not just chemotherapy, but all its other all the other aspects of cancer's invasiveness in our lives, in our psyche, are modified by stress. And I'm sure that Edwards' infidelity did certainly not help.
What about her pushback against that? I mean, she didn't position herself in many ways as a victim. I mean, she you know, the grace and the hopefulness that people talk about, the resilience was clearly her effort to push back. Talk about a mind-body relationship. Can that an effort like that actually, you know, have an effect in pushing back the physical reality of cancer?
Well, I think, as I said, I mean, we don't know exactly how it might affect the physical reality of the cancer, but the experience of cancer, the psyche of it, you know, the ability to endure week after week of therapy and all the complications that, you know, the drive to the hospital, the waiting in the waiting room, the awful conversation with the oncologist and the nurse, etc. You require an enormous degree of reserve to carry that out, and it is no doubt that you know, having this is a moment in which everything comes to the center. So I do think that would have certainly affected her way of thinking.
Eleanor Clift, here's another question from Facebook about John Edwards, who friends say was with her, along with children, friends, family at the time of her death. Just asking simply, Jerry says, what was he doing in the room? What do you know, Eleanor, about their relationship through this pretty stormy seas that would have brought him back there at her deathbed?
Oh, I think it's a very good thing that he was there. And they had been through a lot together, beginning with the death of their 16-year-old son in a
Wade.
Car
mm-hmm.
accident. That's the kind of loss that often destroys marriages. In fact, there's a movie out now called Rabbit Hole, starring Nicole Kidman, which is about a couple who lose a 4-year-old who's chasing the family dog and gets hit by a car. And it's all about how they try to get through that, and it almost takes them apart. So they went through that. Then they their solution, if you will, was to have two more children, which she was in her late 40s when she gave birth to these children. So they have such a long history. And yes, he was unfaithful, and she knew that before they went into the presidential campaign, which was very high-risk behavior given the media's obsession mm-hmm. with people's personal sexual behavior. Mm. And this shared history, I think, even though there are times, I'm sure, when they hated each other, there's also a bond there. And I would like to think, for her sake and for his sake, and especially for the children, their grown daughter and the two little ones, mm-hmm. that they were able to find some measure of peace so that everybody doesn't have to go forward thinking these two people really didn't like each other. I think they loved each other in their own way.
A family friend is being quoted saying, you climb that many mountains and you go through the deepest valley that the two people can possibly go through together, the loss of a child that makes for an incredible bond. One of the things, said Mukherjee, about cancer is it goes on for a long time. Life doesn't get put on hold for as long as cancer can be in someone's life. And so all kinds of things happen. Jobs won and lost, you know, cheating, divorce. This can be an affliction of years and years.
Especially with, you know, in her case, as I understand it, she had an estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, which was detected probably at stage 2 or stage 3. Now, this, again, reminds us how heterogeneous this disease is. Some people live years, 10, 12 years after the diagnosis, and yet others have a relapse and you know, the disease comes back, as it did with Mrs. Edwards. So there's an enormous heterogeneity, and that waiting period, people call it being in the shadow. Mm-hmm. There's a word in cancer culture, which, and there are various terms for it, but it's called being in the shadow. It's a time it's a time when you're still under the shadow of cancer, and yet your life has to go on. Jobs have to happen. Children will grow up, and it's an incredible period of time. Many people have written about it. The journalist Stuart Alsop it's a marvelous book called "Staying the Execution," which reminds us exactly what that period feels like. It's like as if there's an executioner at the other end, and yet there's a stay, and you're locked in this limbo, as it were.
She found out about the cancer right at the end of the effort by John Kerry and John Edwards for the presidency. That was 2004. November 2006, she announced that her cancer was in remission. She said, "I seem to be cancer-free, knock on wood." So how unusual, or what do you make of the fact that it came back, if that's the right phrase, Sid?
You know, there's a spectrum of behavior, and so in some ways, this happens. This is part of the story of many cancers of this sort. As I said, just walking through her story, I think she was quoted as having discovered a plum-sized mass in 2004, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. And that was already a large mass. It was in her own words, it was plum-sized, mm-hmm. And she was incredibly, as typical of her, she was incredibly upfront and frank. I read an interview of her or by her on WebMD. In which she was asked, you know, did you have your mammogram? And she said, you know, like so many people, I knew, and yet I didn't know, in the sense that she said that, you know, she didn't have her mammogram for a while because mm-hmm. she was so busy. It's just a reminder to us that 30% of women in the 50s and 60s are non-compliant. Mammogram isn't a great tool, but it's one of the tools that we have. She discovered the mass actually when it had grown to a plum size, and she felt it herself.
You can imagine that in the midst of a presidential campaign, it would have been maybe too easy to try and push that to the back of one's mind.
Except, of course, that it wasn't pushed to the back. She immediately got attention for it. It was diagnosed very quickly after. And then she had, I think it was found to be estrogen receptor positive. And that's a very important moment because, we often forget, but the fact that this tumor expresses the estrogen receptor really makes a big difference in terms of breast cancer. Breast cancer can be really divided into two big blocks depending on this receptor. And therefore, she had a whole host of tests and therapy and so forth after surgery, even. And that's the typical course of this disease.
Let's take a call from St. Augustine, Florida. William, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, good day. My only comment was I was diagnosed in 2002 in my early 40s with a type of lymphoma, and I find it to be a very scary and private thing. And I think that the courage and grace that she showed by being so public about her condition and her progression through it and the end of it, I think just took tremendous courage that very few people would have the grace and fortitude that she displayed. And I think that she must have just been a tremendous individual. And I think the world has probably lost a very unusual and exceptional person in her.
Certainly a big inspiration. Yes, thank you, William. Eleanor, people make all kinds of decisions about cancer, about how public to be. She was a very public person. In some sense, stripped naked. Her child's death was public. Her husband's infidelity was public. She made her cancer public. I don't know what choices you and your husband made when he was struggling with his own, but what about her very public treatment?
I think she drew strength from talking about it and removing the stigma of cancer. You know, it's not that long ago where people whispered the word cancer and you didn't really want to reveal it. I remember the actor John Wayne, and he called it the Big C. You didn't really want to say the word. And I think there is something exhilarating about the fact that women in particular who are hit with breast cancer feel this great sisterhood and can talk about it. And, you know, my husband really, really did gain a lot of strength in his battle by relating to other people who were facing the same thing. I mean, I think it's a club nobody wants to belong to, but once you're in it, I think you really do want to get up and shout from the rooftops, and you don't want people to back away from you because you have cancer and they don't know what to say. And so I think Elizabeth Edwards made it kind of easy to be around her because you didn't feel like this there was some, you know, force field around her. You can't say certain things. And she talked about the side effects. I know she suffered from neuropathy, which is when you have difficulty walking because mm-hmm. the nerves in your extremities, which is one of the side effects. And, you know, the good thing about all these treatments is that the goal is to have cancer become sort of a chronic disease that can be managed. And so people can live for several years. But the side effects for most of these treatments are are difficult. And I think, you know, she didn't shy away from letting us know that, too.
No, she didn't. And she clearly drew strength from that kind of big conversation, practically, in her case, with the country. Kathy in Dubuque, Iowa. Kathy, you're on the air.
I just wanted to say I knew that she was terminal. I was diagnosed a year ago with stage 2 breast cancer and went through the whole, you know, diagnostic procedure and everything, and in the end was told that I had an 85% chance of survival for 5 years. At this time, I'm still cancer-free, but when you hear news like that, it's kind of like a sucker punch to you that you know, and it's true. Even though they say you're cancer-free, you just kind of sit and wait. And I got visibly upset to my husband, and he said, you know, it's different. She had a different life. She had a lot of stressors. And, you know, my mind automatically goes to, but she had the best doctors in the country, and they couldn't save her. I had no family history. I had mammograms every year. I led a healthy lifestyle, and I was still diagnosed. And I have 2 children at home, and I just hope I get to live to see them get through college and have a productive life. But I don't. We don't know. And that's what you live with every day. And it kind of feels like there's an executioner on the other side. You just never know.
Yeah, Kathy, I'm so glad you voiced that, because I am sure that many, many people around the country had just that response yesterday. If they're in that kind of waiting, under the shadow, as Sid Mukherjee says, Eleanor Clift, I certainly heard it in my own circle. You must have in yours. I mean, people who, you know, have been told your cancer's in remission, and then you see this big figure who it comes back and it takes her.
Well, I don't think anybody who's had cancer really feels cured.
No.
They feel it's nice if you can hit the 5-year mark, but then they will always tell you they know of someone whose cancer returned after 20 years. And my father, who died quite a long time ago from pancreatic cancer, though he had initially stomach cancer, and then the pancreatic cancer was a whole new primary cancer. And so the doctor could speak to this better than I can, but primary cancer, if you can get it and attack it, that's good. But once it metastasizes, it's really metastasized cancer that gets you. And in Elizabeth's case, it metastasized to her liver and probably her bones as well. In my husband's case, it went to his lungs and then his brain. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, when it's in your brain, you don't have brain cancer, you have kidney cancer that is now living in your brain. Yeah. So all of these, and again, Dr. Mukherjee can speak to this, all these different cancers, they're also individual, and we've lumped them together now for hundreds of years.
Right.
But it's a variety of different diseases.
It went to her bones, it went to her liver. Susan in Nahant, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Regarding the fact that Elizabeth Edwards had children, I believe, at 48 and 50.
After her 16-year-old son died. Yes, they went back
exactly.
And...
Exactly. Yeah. Right. If she had fertility treatments, could that have had any influence on or anything to do with her cancer?
Dr. Mukherjee, what do you say?
Well, I mean, you know, this is a question under active investigation right now. It has been investigated deeply before as well, and the quick answer is that to the level of our understanding in most studies, that risk doesn't come up. But that just as a reminder that, you know, every year we need to be more sophisticated about our epidemiological studies. I mean, these studies are becoming more and more sophisticated. In order to find small risks, you have to launch a huge study. But there are ways now that we can do this using molecular techniques that you don't need to, you know, study 10,000, 50,000 women who are undergoing fertility treatment to see if there's any risk. So far, I'm told that there is no increased risk. I mean, the studies have been so far conclusive.
Even though, as you say, she had an estrogen receptor positive form of cancer.
Well, you know, breast cancer being so common, it's very hard. There's a moment I describe in my book in which smoking became so common a risk factor that it was impossible to discern the link between smoking and lung cancer. And so breast cancer is also so common that you have to really do very careful studies to open up a link between one factor and another.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life, fight, and now death of Elizabeth Edwards and the drama played out all over this country every day by unfamous cancer patients and their families. It's a moment to remember her and them, us, everybody who knows the struggle, and certainly many, many families and people in this country do. Eleanor Clift is with us, author of 2 Weeks of Life, contributing editor at Newsweek, and Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, author of The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer. Paula in Scituate, Massachusetts, thank you for calling, Paula. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for this important show. I'm a breast cancer survivor. I was diagnosed on Valentine's Day in 2007 when I was 43, and I also have 2 children. But my point was that one of the things that helped me feel resilient was defining my cancer in my own way. And one thing that I rejected was the battle imagery and the sort of masculine warring imagery, you know, that someone wins or loses. Because I felt like, well, if I, quote-unquote, lose my battle, is that because I didn't try hard enough, or is it just fate? So I ended up talking about my cancer and continue to talk about it in a journey imagery, and that feels more comfortable for me. I was also very public with my friends. I set up a web page and would give updates and try to include all of my emotions, whether I felt sad in the moment, scared in the moment, whether I saw humor in it, which frankly there's quite a bit of humor available if you are able to see that.
Tell us about that, Paula. Where? I want to look at your journey metaphor, but humor in cancer?
Oh, absolutely. Well, just one quick story that comes to mind is, you know, you go through the diagnostics, which in a way is the worst part because it's all this unknown.
Right.
And I remember I was a patient at Mass General Hospital, and going in for a scan, and the scan required a radioactive dye, and the caregivers there, who are extraordinary, one of them said to me, "Now, I am going to inject you with this radioactive dye, but it's clear." And, you know, and her joy at the fact that there was not a color involved.
Great.
But that it was a clear, you know, and it just struck
Super.
Me, this is a small moment, but it just struck me as funny in the moment of, you know, like, you got to be kidding me, that's the bone that I'm being thrown. But when you're in that situation and you let yourself find the humor, you absolutely can. And there's, you know, being a breast cancer survivor, there's lots of ways to make it humorous if you can.
Paula, I appreciate your call so much. Siddhartha Mukherjee, what about it? You've looked at this over a lot of time, and there are all kinds of metaphors, and certainly battle. You know, the battle with cancer, the fight with cancer has been nationally a metaphor for a long time. You hear Paula saying she's turned it to something she thinks of as maybe more feminine, journey instead. I mean, how have the metaphors for cancer changed over time?
I'm going to talk about the metaphor, but I was reminded in Paula's story about a story that was told with both humor, but also was a chilling story, which I recount in the book. Fanny Rosenau, the breast cancer advocate in the 1950s, called up the New York Times, and she said, "I'd like to place an advertisement for survivors of breast cancer." Yeah. And Rosenau writes the story, and she was put on hold, and then finally the society editor comes on the phone, and she says, "Miss Rosenau, you know, the New York Times can't print the words breast and cancer in the Times. Yeah. What if we said that there was a survivors group for women with diseases of the chest wall?"
Oh, boy.
So
that's only 50 years ago.
That's only 50 years ago. So anyway, just a reminder that you know, there's a kind of a chill. The humor can be chilling. Fanny Rosenau was so disgusted by it; she recounted it later as a terrible joke. But it can. There's a chilling quality about it. Now, as far as the metaphor is concerned, I mean, Paula's absolutely right. This metaphor has become punitive for many people. For many people, the idea that you know, you're battling cancer. One patient told me, "You know, doctor, it's your job to do the battle. You battle cancer. My work is to recover, to feel as if, you know, my body's not against me." On the other hand, some people feel that the battle metaphor helps them. And just as I said before, there is, just like there is no archetypal cancer patient, there is no archetypal cancer metaphor. What works is, you know, what works for every individual. And I do think, and Susan Sontag very famously pointed this out, that this metaphor has become punitive for some patients. You know, if you lose the battle, do you then become a loser? And you know, have you given up the fight, as it were? And so I think that's very important. Harold Varmus recently told me, you know, he's the head of the NCI, that he likes the metaphor of a puzzle. he thinks that, you know, you don't win or lose puzzles. Mm-hmm. You solve them, you struggle with them. And I also like this metaphor of journey. I think that's less punitive. You go someplace and you sometimes discover things that are unfortunate that you didn't expect to discover. And I think this is actually a vast improvement to the battle metaphor.
Mm. Paulo, we wish you joy or grace in your journey. Ted, in Dedham, Massachusetts. Ted, you're on the air.
Hi, great show. I've had cancer twice within 10 years of each other, chemo and operative. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on the post-treatment feelings that most of my experience is when the anxiety and what just happened to me really hit. And you're kind of left out there when you survived and you've done well. I know there are groups now, maybe mine was a little while ago, but...
You mean, Ted, when the treatment sort of ends and they usher you out the door and say goodbye and good luck a little bit?
Right, exactly. And you're, like you spoke earlier, when you're in treatment, you're head down, this is what we're doing.
Yep.
Then it's like, wow, look, it's great. You're all better, so-called all better. And good, we'll check up on you in 6 months. And you walk out the door and it's sort of that... WTF just happened to me, you know.
And what did you feel? Was it fear or anger or I don't know what, Ted?
Just the overwhelming experience that my life has just been challenged and that I could have lost it, but I would say, you know, the abstraction of life, the mystery of, you know, coming so close to death, looking... I was a bartender. I had mm-hmm. Robert Parker was a customer of my customer friend.
Great detective writer, yeah.
Right, his illnesses before, and he said, "Whoa, you know." I said, "Well, how'd you like looking into the abyss?" And he said, "It's really dark in there." He was a very funny guy,
yeah.
But it's really what you end up with is being by yourself, and it really helps to talk to other people. Fortunately, family helps. Sometimes I think they have the hardest part of it in a weird way, and. Anger comes in too, especially the second time around, which probably masks a whole lot of fear. But it's that friends that I've had that have been ill, I've said, beware of when it's over if everything works out all right, because the stress of what you just experienced is sitting inside of you, waiting to be dealt with.
Ted, we hear the talker in you, and there's strength in that, and I'm really happy for your sharing that. I mean, Eleanor, what about with you and Tom,
well,
looking at the challenge, the sort of chilling abstraction of it sometimes?
Well, you come to face mortality, which is an abstract idea most of the time, and there it is sort of right in front of you, and there are certain decisions that you have to make, and I was very grateful to Tom that he... arranged for what's called a pre-need package. He arranged for his own cremation and so forth, and he gave me an envelope, and I didn't open the envelope until I needed to, but I was very glad it was there. So, he was more realistic about what was ahead than I was, and he kind of forced me to look at some of the decisions that we had to make. But listening to these callers, mm-hmm. I'm reminded of the book that Hamilton Jordan wrote. He was mm-hmm. Jimmy Carter's yep. chief of staff, and he
right.
faced four different cancers, and it was called No Such Thing as a Bad Day. There's a lot of pressure on cancer patients to be optimistic, and,
yeah.
you know, sometimes, you know, they get really depressed and unhappy, and they need to have room to do that as well. And then this last weekend, there was a dinner in Washington, the Gridiron Dinner. It's a group of journalists. And one of the speakers was Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's a Democratic congresswoman from Florida who was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 44 and had a double mastectomy. And she got up and gave a speech that had people laughing out loud. And she said, "For those of you who speak Republican, I think of my surgery as repeal and replace." And she went on to talk mm-hmm. about her reconstruction mm-hmm. surgery. And she said, "People ask me if they're fake. And I say, they certainly are. The real ones tried to kill me." And,
oh, boy.
Right. And she said, and they feel real. At least that's what the TSA agents tell me. So she got a lot of humor out of what was a very searing experience, obviously,
wow.
for
wow.
her.
Wow. Joan in Washington, Connecticut. Joan, you're on the air.
Yes, I am. Thank you so very much.
Hi.
And we're all humbled by the courage and the strength of people who suffer and cope with both the battle and the journey of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
You've had many calls from people who have had cancer. I'm calling because I want to talk about the doctors who treat cancer. I have a daughter-in-law who is a pediatric oncologist. Mm-hmm. I think she was probably a colleague of the doctor you have. She was at Sloan Kettering and Cornell Weill.
Mm.
Now she's at the National Institutes of Health at the Cancer Institute. And if people could just step back and realize what it is for these doctors, especially, if in my opinion, who are treating the littlest children,
yeah,
who suffer from these absolutely incredibly horrible diseases, and then embrace them and their parents in this effort to bring them to health and continuing life. I think we need to honor the people who have the disease and suffer through everything that's been discussed, but I also think we need to honor the doctors.
John, I'm so glad you raised that. And Siddhartha Mukherjee, let me put that to you. I mean, who hasn't wondered, how do these doctors, maybe you, deal with that? You know, talk about cancer patients looking to the abyss, and they do, and their families do. But the doctors who are there every day with a disease that doesn't seem like it's, you know, a cure is around the corner.
Well, it's our job, we sign a pledge to do it well. We draw our strength from the patients, ultimately, people talk about heroic doctors, but the heroism of medicine, as I point out in my book, is just reflected heroism. It is really the patient who's undergoing the experience, and medicine is there to help when it can, and it can do diverse sets of things. And my general opinion about this is, let's take all of this heroism, the anger, the resilience, and let's bring it into political action.
What does that mean? Bring it into political action.
And by that I mean let's find ways to fund good science, good medicine, and that doesn't just mean, you know, I'm not talking about medicine that only deals with the body, but medicine that deals with the soul, medicine that deals with the psyche, and really study this enormous family of diseases and try our best to convert many of them into chronic diseases. There is an enormous degree of knowledge that has come out from the 1990s onwards about cancer, and our job now is to translate that knowledge into clinical paradigms, into clinical realities, and that's what we're facing.
You know, I want to ask you, because there's also, along with uncertainty, there's skepticism out there. I mean, here's a web comment from a listener in North Carolina. Says, with all her wealth and intelligence, Elizabeth Edwards was not saved. I wonder, she writes, if palliative care without the torture of unlikely treatment may have given her a better quality of life in her final months. Here's the skepticism. Cancer becomes an industry, our listener writes.
Well, you know, I think that would be particularly nihilistic to say that cancer is an industry. Now, Elizabeth Edwards had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. The management of this disease has transformed in the last 50 years. The relationship, for instance, the discovery of tamoxifen or anti-estrogens, mm-hmm, has really transformed the management of this disease, and there have been significant gains in survival. It is, in fact, I know Mrs. Edwards had about 6 years since her diagnosis, mm-hmm, but estrogen receptor positive breast cancer is one of the successes can be counted as one of the successes of cancer therapy. The quick story is that you know, it was a Scottish surgeon who was walking in the Highlands of Scotland who was told by some shepherds that removing the ovaries changed the lactation of cows. That was how we began to figure, mm-hmm, out, mm-hmm, that there's a relationship between the ovaries and the breast, and that's how essentially ultimately we discovered tamoxifen in the 1960s. So I do think that the skepticism is good because it keeps us on our toes and reminds us how far we have to go. But on the other hand, especially for estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, I think that the disease has really transformed.
And Eleanor, here's another note of skepticism where people trying to think about public figures. Again, a web comment: we didn't know Elizabeth Edwards, and we never will. What we knew was a media figment, a manufactured victim You knew her in political realms or saw her there, Eleanor. What about that?
Elizabeth Edwards I saw was very warm and outgoing and approachable. There are so many people in public life who wear such a mask, and when you have a conversation with them, it's boilerplate. It might as well be a press release. Mm-hmm. She instantly connected. But some of the coverage of her, particularly in the book Game Change, really portrayed her in a very negative light. And you know, a lot of it comes blind quotes from campaign aides, so I don't know that I fully trust it. It can, and I also wondered if she was suffering from some of the after effects of some of the treatments that she went through, where she might not have always been fully rational. And God knows, I would excuse her every one of those moments, considering what she was going through, not only with her disease but in her personal life. But she just is a woman and a political figure that I think people universally relate to, wherever you are on the political spectrum.
Yeah, well, maybe we never entirely know in public figures. Maybe we never know entirely in ourselves. But I sat right across this table from her, and I found her deeply moving and inspirational. And I think many people whose themselves and their families have struggled with cancer have surely taken that kind of inspiration from her. And today, not sitting across the table anymore, not with us any longer, Elizabeth Edwards, one day gone. And we thank her for her grace and her courage while she was here. Thank the two of you for being with us this hour. Eleanor Clift at Newsweek, author of 2 Weeks of Life. Eleanor, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
And Siddhartha Mukherjee, author of The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer. Thank you for coming in today in New York, Siddhartha.
Thanks. It was a pleasure remembering Mrs. Edwards.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby, with help from Mackenzie Knowles-Kerson and Jessica Willingham. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.